Rewind and Digress is a FakeShem.net podcast proudly presented by Viewlorium. Alternative movies, alternative streaming, totally free at Viewlorium.com.
Welcome to Rewind and Digress, where we hit pause on the now and track back to one of our favourite films, trap it, torture it, take a peek below at what came before it and decide whether it's finger-licking good. I'm Jarrett, and I'm with Glenn and Sean, and we're FakeShemp.net. On this episode, we're rewinding back to 2009 for writer-director Sean Byrne's modern horror classic, The Loved Ones. Now, gentlemen, I'm going to go around. I'll go with you first, Glenn. When was the first time you saw The Loved Ones?
I missed it at the cinemas. It was simply home entertainment release.
That's fair enough. It was a pretty brief theatrical run and a long wait too.
There was a lot of fanfare about this one before I got to it. So I went to it when the buzz was all around.
Right,
it's a phenomenal film. I think it's one of the greatest Australian films of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's it. Like, not just Australian genre films, but Australian films.
I agree. Yep, totally.
Completely. Now, Sean,
first time I saw it, it really wasn't that long ago.
Right,
maybe
Tuesday.
Yeah, probably Tuesday. Yeah. I'd seen it once before. It was about a year ago, maybe a year and a half. It was really recent, which is a bizarre thing because the guy I used to get to shoot our films, a guy called Sham, is a legend. Sean, the director of The Loved Ones, is his best man.
All right.
Yeah. Right. So when we were sort of bumming around and making commercials and all that, then The Loved Ones had posters around. He was always like, "Yeah, man, like I've seen it. Yeah, like Sean's wicked. Sean's a legend. Like this film's great." And and it just never appealed to me. And I finally caught up with it. I picked it up at Cashies for like $2 or something. I thought, I'll give it a spin. And then, so I saw it way, 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 way down the line. About a year and a half ago.
And probably. What was your feeling when you first watched it?
It was overrated.
I guess you saw it a number of years after it came out. There was a fair bit of hype for the film when it came out.
Yeah.
I mean, now I don't think...
It was a festival baby. You know. Like, it was doing... Like, didn't it...
It did, yeah.
Was it, like, opening or closing night at TIFF or something?
Yeah,
like
well, it was... Like, it had its world premiere at MIFF where I saw it, but then it went on to play, TIFF as one of the Midnight Madness films. And actually, I think it picked up an award there, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, but with the buzz aside, like, it holds up. It's like... It's a phenomenal film.
Regardless.
I'm going to debunk everything you said. I just think it is absolutely fucking incredible.
Like, feel free. What I feel like Sean Byrne did was, I feel like he pulled a bit of a Tarantino, right? In that, if you think about Reservoir Dogs is just the last 20 minutes of Ringo Lam's City on Fire, right? And he's just kind of pulled it out to make a 90-minute feature. And I feel Sean Byrne has done the same thing, where he's just taken the last 15 minutes of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and just pulled it out to make this feature. And it's not that it's a bad film, right? Because it's not, right? It's
a
fine. Like it's perfectly passable. It looks really handsome. Mm. Like the sound design particularly is really clever. The soundtrack's great. It's got great local bands, British Indian, all that kind of stuff. Mm. But I just feel like I've seen it before.
Yeah, but you love Reservoir Dogs, yeah?
Yeah, but I think Reservoir Dogs is overrated. I think Tarantino in general is overrated for that exact exact reason. Is everything he's done,
it's pastiche.
We've seen it done a thousand times before.
I agree with the Tarantino statement. Not so much about Reservoir Dogs. Yes, it's a pastiche, but I still think it's an incredible debut.
Yeah,
I mean, totally. We'll never see his real debut. That whatever.
My best friend's wedding.
Yeah,
or
that
whatever.
One. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I think Reservoir Dogs stands up. I think that and Jackie Brown are the only two Tarantino films I can kind of return to watch, and probably more so Jackie Brown.
I agree.
For me, it's the first three that I can return to.
Yeah.
I can't do Pulp Fiction anymore.
Can't you? Okay.
It's too hard.
Seen it to death.
But look, we've digressed.
There lies
super
our first
digression,
hey.
I'm just going to mention the first time I saw the film, before I saw the film, my old housemate, Tommy McSweeney, who now lives in Sydney, is a professional editor. But back in the day when he was getting into doing work on films, he was a runner. And he was the runner on The Loved Ones. And so he was telling me about this film as it was being made. Mm. And he was like, "Oh, man, you're not going to believe it. It's oh, it's like one of his favorite films was like Aliens, and he would watch it religiously. And he actually was in the opinion of that Alien vs. Predator was a pretty good film. No, it wasn't. I still haven't seen Alien vs. Predator 2 Requiem. I will get there. But he just kept going on about it. It's like, oh, look, I don't know. Aussie horror hasn't been good for a while. And the way he was sort of describing it, I was like, oh, I don't know. I don't know about this at all. And then, yeah, I caught it at MIFF because it played MIFF as its, I think, MIFF Premier Fund had, you know, investment in the film. So I saw the world premiere at MIFF and I was floored. I just couldn't believe this film had come out of Australia. Like, especially after, you know, I mean, like, had Wolf Creek come out maybe a year before?
Possibly.
It was considerably. I think Wolf Creek might have came out.
2006,
2007? 2005, 2006.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it was about 3 or 4 years
that
beforehand.
That had been the kind of caliber of horror we'd done, which at the time I thought was like, again, it was just a reworking of things we'd seen overseas with a slightly, you know, with an Australian identity about it, but it wasn't terribly original.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the mass hysteria of people really loving it. Oh, my God, it's... And... But this film, I thought, was completely worthy of it. Everyone that came out of it was just
and I think, too, it's intentionally pastiche. Like, you know, you were saying how it's, you know, it's the last 20 minutes of Chainsaw Massacre, but it's also 16 Candles. Like, it's John Hughes infused.
Yeah, that's see, and they're the things that you rarely see injected into horror films. Yeah. Maybe more so now since, like, with films like The Babysitter and things like that, but... In 2009, I wasn't really used to seeing that.
Good comparison there.
Where does it... I see... Maybe I'm just... maybe it's just completely bypassed me. Where does this... Everybody keeps saying it's like John Hughes meets Wolf Creek, but I don't understand why. Like, I was
the color palette. Look at the...
Well, the color palette, it's got the teenage angst and yeah, the soundtrack-driven sort of, you know, design to it.
I just don't see it.
Have you seen John Hughes' Reach the Rock?
No.
It's the loved ones without the horror.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, right. No, I don't know. And the more you think about it, like, the more it kind of falls apart as well. Like, what's the lead actress, what's her name?
Lively, Robin Lively.
Yeah.
McLevy.
Is it McLevy?
Yeah, McLevy. Is that I've seen her beyond this. You know, she popped up. She was in Hell on Wheels. And she was really good.
Five seasons.
Right? Yeah, five seasons or something like that. And she's a really solid actress. Mm. But I feel like in The Loved Ones, she just kind of wanders in from another film.
No, she's her debut, isn't it?
She had done another feature prior to this. Had done like a bit of tally, but she did do another feature. I can't recall. I think it was like a relationship.
But
comedy.
She wasn't unknown, so you can't expect her to come and do.
I mean that her character just feels like it just wandered in from another film. Like, up until her, like, I feel like she's...
Sean, are you talking about The Loved Ones 2009 directed by Sean Byrne?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just double checking.
Where she's...
You can't see me doing this double take at the moment. Like,
she's,
what?
Her and her father both feel like they're these... Up until their introduction, the film is gritted, you know, is grounded in this kind of gritty realism, you know, like he's got this trauma of his dad and he's turned a bit to drugs and he's doing his own thing and, you know, he's trying to find himself.
Well,
and
hang on, before we do this, let's I just want to read the synopsis because we're covering some pretty cool plot points right there. So this is the official synopsis supplied by Mad Men that's on their DVD and whatnot. It says, after high schooler Brent Mitchell wraps his car around a tree, killing his father, he escapes into a marijuana-fueled world of heavy metal music to block the pain and guilt. Sounds like someone's grandmother wrote it. he's kept grounded by his beautiful and caring girlfriend, Holly, who's also his date for the upcoming school formal dance. As graduation approaches, Lola Stone, the weirdest girl in school, asks Brent to the dance but is turned down. Hours before the dance and under the glittering light of a disco ball, Brent wakes up in a nightmarish sequence of events involving pink satin, glitter, syringes, nails, and power drills. Brent has become the prom king at a macabre, sadistic dance where he is the entertainment. I love that last line.
Yeah.
It's a really good synopsis. Like, it is, you know.
It is.
It really
captures it reminds me just... I didn't really draw the comparison until I heard you read that.
Mm.
There's that Lucky McKee film, May.
Oh, yeah.
I think May is a much stronger film.
No, I don't think so.
No, I don't.
That's
know,
you're not... You don't have to agree. Either of you.
There was a lot of hype for May, and I enjoyed it, but I don't know. I just never really liked Lucky McKee.
I did love the woman, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
And he kind of introduced this whole sort of John Hughes infusion with, you know, all cheerleaders must die and all that kind of stuff. So he's sort of responsible in a roundabout way for this kind of genre.
True.
Mind
you, that came after this.
No, the original. He remade it for
the
feature film. He did a feature film on Super 8, I think.
Yeah.
And then remade it in Hollywood. Hollywood way.
Okay, interesting.
That's what put him on the map, the original one.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, so I think he kind of pioneered this crossbreed of movie. And sorry, I just drew that comparison when you read the synopsis there.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. Okay, so back onto the attack there. Sure, what else? You were talking about Robin McLeavy's performance before.
Oh, yeah. It seems up until the point where they show up, they're so obtusely weird. Like, they're so self-consciously weird.
Isn't that the basis for so much horror with the rednecks in the cabins and inbred families?
But I think that the difference for me is when you see those rednecks in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or you see the rednecks in The Hills Have Eyes, you know, there's always that part where it's just like, how are they getting away with this? Oh, it's because they live in the middle of the desert. Like, they'd be where I feel like this house is
as remote as the Chainsaw Massacre house.
Yeah, but I'm also going to say, like, apart from Lola's interaction with Brent when she asked him to the dance and then spies, you know, him getting some old sex, I think, in the car, in the VW, you don't see Daddy until the house
you don't.
So, like, I mean, I haven't seen any more of Lola except for being an awkward girl at high school, which, I mean, I've known plenty of girls that were like that.
How did they get away with this when it's not that remote? Well, how did Jeffrey Dahmer get away with it in his house? How did bloody Ed Gein get away with it?
Like, I think they're not subtly, awkward.
I don't think there's nothing subtle about them.
In their own house, sure, but that's different because they can do whatever they want.
Put a face
but
outside of that,
that's where the jam comes in for me. Is up until that point, there is a certain degree of nuance, you know, with her, you know, like she's very, you know, almost dialogue less, you know, and she just conveys it with looks and she looks her slunched shoulders and all that kind of stuff. But then as soon as you get into her house, it becomes this,
it's her comfort zone,
pantomimic. Exactly, that ramped up self-conscious performance is what completely drew me out.
This is the typical trait of every serial killer. It's the guy next door that you never saw coming.
True. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that might have been a bit awkward and
just because I don't buy her performance. I don't buy how there's no nuance or subtlety. Everything's really, you know, cartoonish. That doesn't mean that it doesn't exist in real life. But it's just, for me, watching the film, where there's been so much heavy stuff going on up until now, you know, like, the kid kills his own dad.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it's like this kind of, I don't know, like, really obnoxiously self-aware.
Flick the switch, though. It's like that, that unassuming movie that just turns it on its head.
Totally. Yeah.
I don't buy it.
Well, since we've spoken about Robin's performance as Lola, we can probably move on from her. I personally thought she was fantastic. I think she's conveys a certain coldness, brutality. She's got, you know, crack wises. Yeah. And then at the same time, I think there's a feminine quality about her that kind of makes her a little bit
endearing.
Sexy as
She's endearing. Yeah, I mean, a chick with a drill, you know, like, yeah, it's hot.
Yeah, there's something bizarre about it. We're dressed in pink satin.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about Xavier Samuel, you know, who plays Brent, the lead in this film, and arguably, in my opinion, probably his best role.
He's
done a lot of films since.
Well, let's quickly talk about some of those. He did Twilight.
Yes.
Fury.
That's right.
Healing.
Yeah.
He was in Bait.
Healing. I love Healing.
Healing's good.
I know the director of Healing.
Glenn's Craig. Moving out to Craig. where they shot the movie. It's sure. set.
Yes, and a few best men, so just amongst others.
You failed to mention his all-time worst performance film, which is actually one of the... Because he's in those two, A Few Best Men.
Yes, he is.
And you downright hate the sequel.
I did a What the Fuck Was That micro podcast about the film.
Well, he's also been in possibly the worst Australian film ever made, Spin Out. I
deliberately left that out.
Any time is Spin Out. He was also in, obviously, Bait, and he was in a film called, I think it's called Road Train?
Yes.
Yeah, it's another Aussie horror. So
is that the one with
familiar.
David Argue?
Oh, I don't know.
I think it is.
Now.
It's about the killer truck.
The killer truck, that's the one.
And
I haven't
they
seen
open
it for a while.
They open the truck's bonnet, and it's all, like, organic, like, flesh and stuff.
Yeah,
it's
weird.
That sounds gnarly.
It's not bad. It's
really?
It was like one of those films that I just stumbled on. I think I stumbled on an American Netflix. I was on another title, like Roadkill or something. And then I was like, what? This is an Aussie film. I've never heard of this. Anyway, Xavier Samuel's performance, I think, is exceptional because he doesn't have a lot of dialogue in the film.
Yeah, he's got to carry the lion's share.
He does. And it's all through expression. Yeah.
He's dragged through the mud in this one.
And it's not just that, because the whole film only takes place over... I mean, it's not too far removed from real time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
true. But Xavier Sam... Well, I say that once he gets into the house, then it's almost in real time. He's got to get to like this fever pitch level of hysteria and then just maintain that for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Where he's just got to that level of intensity. That would be exhausting.
Like imagine doing the pickups like in
trying to get back into that moment.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and he's, again, he does really
the
switch, well.
You know, he's been there and he's being tortured, you know, within an inch of his life. But at the same time, there's that brooding look on him that, you know, you're going to get your comeuppance and I'm going to be the one that's going to bring it.
Yeah.
You know, throughout it, just that look on his face, that menacing look that's you know, staring back at
the inevitable. Yeah.
Yeah. He takes a licking, but he keeps on ticking. Anyway, moving on. John Brumpton. We couldn't talk about this film if we didn't talk about John Brumpton in this movie.
The Aussie staple.
If you're looking for a new Mac product, Emery Cell is the place for you. Don't throw your money away on stupidly expensive Apple gear when Emery Cell provides top-of-the-line, totally refurbished products across the Apple range. Whether you need a new iPhone, iMac, Mac Pro, iPad, or other Apple products, visit Emery Cell. And if you're looking to sell your Apple gear for whatever reason, Emery Cell can offer a generous price with full data erasure, fast payment, and free shipping. Visit Emery Cell's website to see for yourself. FakeShemp.net uses their products and they wouldn't steer you wrong. Visit emerysale.com.au.
Hey guys, don't forget to catch our other show, Franchised, where we cast our attention on movies and their sequels, prequels, spin-offs, and cash-ins.
That chase sequence around the living room?
That chase sequence around the living room was unreal.
It was. It reminded me of that movie, The Garbage Pail Kids.
Where totally.
Yeah. You know what number one? Actually, I think I know what number one is.
What is number one?
I think it's Whitney Houston from The Bodyguard.
Oh, high five.
Tune into Franchised at FakeShemp.net. Heck, you could just Google FakeShemp.net podcast and prepare your ear holes for penetration.
We couldn't talk about this film if we didn't talk about John Brumpton
John
in this
Brumpton,
movie.
The Aussie staple.
The character actor.
Look, I've been thinking, like, it's really hard for me to define what his best work is, but I think if I had to do, like, maybe three or four, this would be amongst them, without a doubt.
Yeah,
but
totally.
Then, like, you know, you got Romper Stomper, Porno, which
Porno
is
more recently,
and Storm Warning.
Storm Warning.
There's a lot of comparisons to that film in this one.
Totally.
See, I think Storm Warning works much better.
That's another discussion.
It's a different podcast.
No, but I think there's similarity with the production design and the values and all that kind of stuff. But I think they're his best films, and I think this is wedged somewhere amongst all of
those. It's a very restrained performance
because
he does play a psychotic deranged type of character.
Porno might be his best.
You know, I think Porno is his best because it was really his film.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just such a good performance because, like, he just wants to make his daughter happy.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a weird incest thing throughout the film. Like he's
watching her change
into the dress.
Oh, it's
and
so
then they're doing, you know, that he's awarded the prom king and they have their dance and they're about to kiss.
And he's like
he's dropping the glitter on them.
Like and he's perfectly happy too.
He's
as well.
Watching
I love
Lola
that
takes,
stuff so much.
Lola takes Brent's penis out and you know, he's just sort of watching on and it's really uncomfortable, but yeah, like I just love his performance in it because
he is way more restrained than she is,
isn't he?
But that's required. That's totally required for the character juxtaposition there.
Yeah.
So now we've just talked about the glitter and whatnot. The production design of the film, like it's a standout. Like the cinematography, production design, costuming.
The cinematography,
it's one of the things that I think takes it up a notch over most Australian films. This film looks like it's on a much bigger budget than what it was. I think it was like about $4 million.
Massive bang for buck.
It just looks phenomenal. So many Aussie films I'm used to seeing in this day and age that look like they're shot for TV. And then, you know, you go and see it in the cinema and you're like, where's the distinction between what's cinematic and what's really just a made-for-TV movie? Yeah. This is pure cinema.
Without a doubt. You know what it reminded me of? There's another Australian film which got my Glenn Award with the Fake Shemp Awards, which Girl Asleep.
Oh, you know, I absolutely thought that too. When I was rewatching it recently, I was like, wow.
Because it's a minimalist film in its production value. Like, it's just whatever we can get our hands on at op shops and let's make it look good.
Yeah.
And it ends up looking fantastical. It's very colourful. And non-realistic. Like, really...
It's very quite... Both films are very vibrant sort of films. Yes. Yeah, they're kind of dark, but they're, you know...
Well...
And they've got that fantasy element
Girl Asleep has a history where it comes from a children's theatre background. And you kind of feel like even The Loved Ones could have come from a children's theatre background and they've just sort of put it into this adult world.
True.
So very similar productions. And then Storm Warning. Like, it's very... similar one set location kind of piece, you know, where it's all closed in and same kind of family, I suppose.
Yeah, all right, well,
I want to make a special mention to that Mirrorball. It's mentioned in the synopsis, but it's a fucking amazing touch because that Mirrorball adds like a texture to everything in the film, where it's the faces, everything it touches, the surfaces. It's like you could look at the image and go, geez, that's really well composed and it's beautifully shot, but just having that just adds this extra layer to it.
It's
and
filling the void,
fantasy
it
element
fills the
to
void,
it.
Yeah,
absolutely, yeah. And it keeps you feeling like you really are trapped in that one environment, you know, that entire time.
Absolutely.
In that small space, their living room, kitchen.
I mean, the key to any production design when you're doing independent filmmaking is to just crowd the scene. You know, like never have a blank piece of wall. Like always have something that's distracting the viewer's eye. And that Mirrorball is constantly moving. So your eyes are sort of all over the place.
It's very psychedelic.
Yeah.
Range of music in the film that's really carefully curated to drive the plot. You've got the acoustic teenage heartbreak anthem that opens it. And then you've got like... aggressive sort of metalcore, Parkway Drive on the soundtrack. And who would have thought that Casey Chambers, Not Pretty Enough.
It'd
become such a chilling fucking song.
She
wants to play it at her wedding.
Would become,
what, her dad?
Yeah. The perfect song for this
so
film.
So good. Yeah. And it pops up a few times through it.
I know, I will never listen to it the same way again.
Never. Now, you mentioned this earlier, Sean, is the sound design and the score. The score itself is done by Ollie Olsen, who was in a lot of post-punk bands throughout the late 70s into the late 80s. He was in a band with Michael Hutchins, Max Q. But the sound design on it,
sound design in particular, is really standout stuff.
I concur.
Excellent. I think we've talked enough about the style of the film. But now you did mention that you felt like it was like, you know, the last 20 minutes of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre dragged out. In my opinion, though, this film's relatively short. It's only about 80 odd minutes.
Not even. I think it's very short.
I think it clocks in at
75 minutes.
It's a cracking pace. And I mean, within the first 10 minutes, you cover a lot of ground. You know, you establish most of the major players, and you know their motives harks back to, you know, what to come, because you have that car crash at the start and you see the first victim. Mm. So it's almost like this destination, or a destiny moment sort of thing. Yeah, that things are going to end up perpetual where they started. You know, you've got like lots of themes: parental bonds, tragedy, mateship, love, sex, jealousy, anger, more. Sex, in fact, you've got sex in a VW, which according to Moratz is probably one of the most uncomfortable places you could have sex. That would have been a logistical nightmare shooting that scene. Like, I don't know how they did it. They must have had a Malcolm car split in half to set up cameras.
Yeah, David Parker came on set for the day.
those two were awesome. The goth girl and the best pal.
Yeah, totally.
They were unreal. Really good. I mean, outside of being really good players, really good dynamic between them. Particularly him. I thought he was dynamite.
It was incredible. One of the things I sort of noticed this time around, like I've seen the film three times, recently rewatched it with a commentary track, but there were little things that maybe I didn't pick up the first time, or maybe I did know the first time and now watching it a number of years later, but like it is quite a clever plot because, you know, you got that boy walking along the road at the start. He turns out to be the boy that's in the photograph that's in the scrapbook, who turns out to be the brother of the girl that's dating the friend.
Tight.
And it's really cool. It's really, you know, sort of well woven.
Yeah,
sort of
there's
story.
No loose ends.
No.
There's no fat on it whatsoever.
Now, themes in the films, guys, like, I mean, there's a lot of themes, but I guess the biggest one's trauma. You know, there's a massive trauma he's gone through at the start. He's behind the wheel, kills his old man, inadvertently kills his old man in an accident. His mother blames him for it, so he's kind of living with that blame. He's a self-mutilator, so he's dealing with the pain in that sort of way. He can't really express his feelings toward his girlfriend.
Can't
he writes
say,
in the card
and
she
reads it
later.
Trauma is one of the things that really came to mind when I'm watching it, but you're right.
But then, but it takes the trauma of actually going through all those events in the films for him to appreciate those people around him as well. Because he has that, there's a montage where he's being tortured and he's about to die pretty much. And he sees all the people in his life that he loves and what they mean to him.
It's the foundation
and
of his
will
resilience.
To live. And then he finds the will to live again. So, like, he's come through it on the other side and you're like, geez, maybe he's going to be all right. But I mean, he's pretty fucked up to begin with, but he goes through a whole lot more.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it kind of teaches him the value of life. What are you? Is there any themes off the top of your head? I mean, you just said that one didn't come to mind, but any...
It didn't, but it does when you say it that way. Once again, it's not a film that I've really dissected. I've seen it twice. One was, you know, way back when it came out, and then I guess I watched it probably about 6 months ago.
And I
should watch it more.
After watching it this time, I felt like, God, I need to watch this film more.
Because
it's so
short, that
it's
impact
such a
on me.
Great film.
Had that impact on me both times.
Exactly, yeah. I think all three times, even the last time I watched it was with the commentary track, but I'd sometimes not be listening to what Sean was saying because I'd just be like kind of watching the film again.
That's not me.
Sean Byrne, the director, writer-director. Sean wasn't talking over the film while he watched it. I was like, shut up, Sean, this is why you hate the film.
Imagine that commentary.
That'd be a great commentary. Maybe that'll be on the anniversary edition.
I mean, love. I always thought that love was the big thing. The big theme for me.
Obsession.
Trauma, you know, obsession. Yeah. You know, there's, you know, his love for his dad that he can't let go of. There's, you know,
love for Lola.
Yes.
Daddy's love for Lola, Lola's love for God, what's his name?
Well, let's call him Xavier.
Yeah, Xavier Simons. Yeah. Brent, there's the want of love between the best pal and the goth girl.
Yeah.
You know, there's the love of the goth girl's parents to her. Like,
what's the name of the film?
The Loved Ones?
Yeah, that's right.
Makes sense. Plural. Mind blown.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, like, it's, those are, all those relationships and their dynamics are really clearly played for, in an exceptionally efficient way as well.
You have probably brought up a very, very good point there, because as I said, like, the loved ones, and that is referring to every character in the film.
Even my
trauma thing, I was bringing love into it, but clearly love is the overpowering
the guy that fucking hates the film is the one that really taps into it,
no, I want to be clear it's not that I hate it by any stretch.
No Karate Kid 3.
It's no the next Karate
next
Kid.
Karate Kid.
It's not that I don't hate it by any stretch. I think it is largely overrated, but it's certainly better than most Australian stuff that comes out. You know, genre stuff. I think, you know, in that regard,
except for Storm Warning, right?
Except for Storm Warning.
Storm Warning's a very underrated film.
It is
very underrated.
Everett Darosh.
And Jamie Blanks.
I love Jamie Blanks.
All right, gents. So, favorite scenes from the film. Like, you know, do I need to give you a minute to think about it and I'll talk about my favorite scene? Or can I just throw it to you?
No, go for it. You talk. Okay.
Don't talk for me.
What about Glenn?
I'm not important.
Yeah. My favorite scene's when Brent's tied to the chair and he requests to go to the bathroom. It's a clearly sort of like a thinly veiled plan to escape. They see through it. Subsequently, Lola sculls a pint of milk and then takes out Brent's schlong, puts it in the glass and, you know, says, go for it sort of thing. He can't go. Daddy gets the old hammer out and threatens to nail it to the chair. And suddenly it gets a bit of squirtage going and he's crying. Oh, it's crying.
It's crying.
And I'm just like, oh, it's such a fucking awkward and uncomfortable moment. And then she's like, maybe I should kiss it. And then immediately snaps and turns into that, you know, that horrible character of, or I could bite it off. You know, so your girlfriend can't ever, you know. It's just a really fucking intense moment. Yeah. It's terrifying. The great fear.
Do you know what I love about that story? He delivered that so conservatively, right? And then he goes, it's such a fucking awful scene.
I never said the words cock. I never said piss. I said piss. I might have said urinate. I said schlong.
It's a great scene. That's such an intense scene. Probably one of the best scenes in the film. Yeah. Obviously, the drill scene is just...
Oh, it's killer. And then it's just like, I need... Make the hole bigger. Even bigger. You're like, oh my God. Jesus.
Yeah, that's mine because I love that kind of stuff.
What about you? Surely another favorite scene would be the bit where he falls, where they're throwing rocks at him in the tree and he falls out of the tree. Hits the Kingswood.
The car.
It's funny, but it's awful. And when the body makes that impact, it's like, oh.
Yeah.
But you kind of laugh. I forgot all about that.
Yes.
It's a great scene.
Great stunt. Yeah.
The drill scene.
On the Kingswood, I think. Too.
Oh, the nailing the feet. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Was it the feet? Yeah.
Then he uses that to kill Daddy. Stabs him in the neck about 9 times.
Oh,
it's brutal. Like, it's such a brutal film.
When he catches the drill across his face,
and
pulls that big sliver
of
skin
so
off
good.
Of his face.
Like, the actual makeup effects in this film look phenomenal.
They're very good.
Really good.
Speaking of that brutality, it was originally rated R.
Yes.
I'm sure you've got that in your notes.
No,
there.
I didn't. Okay, but I was just going to mention it.
But they dropped it to MA based on the comedic element.
They appealed to get it. And I mean, that's a smart decision.
The comedy is what saved them.
Wow.
Yeah. Because otherwise, I mean, how many, you know, you cut it like such a massive part of the audience out when it goes for an R.
It is deserving of an R rating.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Yeah.
It is super. It's like, it is honestly like Catsick Blues. Getting an MA and not an R is mind-blowing.
Yeah.
Like, those two films are fairly brutal films.
That just boggles my mind that got an MA.
It is. And I mean, like, Catsick Blues, yes, it's got a dark humor about it. And I think the second time and third time you watch it, you find it funnier and funnier. But the very first time, I found it very traumatic and
deplorable.
Shocking.
It's deplorable.
Yeah, I came out of it and I'd said to Glenn, nah, I did not enjoy it. I thought it was way too much. It was fucking making me feel very
meanwhile,
uneasy.
I just jizzed my pants.
Yeah, he was loving it. And then when I watched it the second time, I was like, nah, it was fucking great. It was really
oh, really?
Fun.
I didn't know you'd come around on that
I
one.
I know you really liked it. Yeah, it's very similar. I know, not really in the same league in my opinion as these two films, but I quite like it. Is Hostel. I hated it the first time I saw it in the cinemas. I absolutely hated it.
Yeah, I was the same.
Second time, watched it 5 years later, I thought it was hysterical.
You know, it was Hostel 2 that turned really me around funny. On that. That was a phenomenal film.
Hostel 2 is a fantastic sequel.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And again, very funny. I think I knew where to come from watching that. Like, what I was ready for humor.
Watch your syllables there.
Well, watch out. He's crying.
I think my favorite sequence is when the best friend shows up to the girl for the date with the flowers.
Yeah, right.
Because I think their relationship is
reeking
really,
of weed as well. And yeah, the father's like, a cop.
Yeah, reeking of weed, and the dad shows up, and your heart stops for this poor kid.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, you know, those roses, yeah, oh, yeah, God, I couldn't find them in black. I'm like, yeah, good, nice. She shows up basically wearing her nightie, and she's like, are we going or what? And I'm like, oh, I know where this is going to go. And then every time those two show up on screen after that,
it's great.
I think,
magic.
Yeah, I think it's the chemistry between those two is unreal. Yeah, really those were the highlights for me.
Well, she falls out of the car when they get to the prom, and he has to run around to his sister because they've just been smoking joints in the car listening to metal.
Yeah. I smell a spin-off.
right. I really enjoyed it.
This is like the fucking Harold and Lloyd or whatever.
Oh, Harold and
Out of Control. No.
Oh, no. You're like the Get Smart spin-off
cycle.
Made for DVD
cycle.
Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's a digression and a half.
Well, now I think we should digress. Sean Byrne mentions on the commentary track his love of teen films. Those are John Hughes, obviously. But he also mentions that Richard Linklater's Dazed and Confused is his favourite teen film of all time, which I fucking love. And Glenn's a massive fan of the spiritual sequel.
Yeah.
Everybody Wants Some. It was like your number one film
a
couple years back.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've watched that about 7 times.
Have you really?
I have, yeah.
Do you know what? I still haven't seen it.
It's a solid film.
I've got it sitting there. I haven't watched
it. It gets better every time, too.
It's a solid film.
You pick up on all the little things you never picked up on before every time you watch it.
Got to watch it.
I got to watch it, yeah.
So on that note, I was going to ask you, lads, what would be your favourite teen film?
Oh, my
you know,
God,
it
man.
Well, yeah, I'll give you one and you can have an honourable mention.
Wait, does it have to be... Is it any teen film?
Any teen film.
Holy shit.
I know
decade,
exactly what mine is.
Anything. Can be serious, could be comical, could be anything.
Scream.
Yeah. Okay.
Hands down.
Yeah.
Hands down.
Oh
Scream
God,
changed everything for me.
What? Yeah.
That changes how
I went to school to see Scream.
That changes how I'm coming into this.
It's a real teen sort of thing to do.
Because I just had teen comedy in mind when you said it.
But yeah. Well, yeah.
It's kind of a comedy.
Yeah.
I don't know. Instinct says Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because I know
classic.
It back to front.
Do you know I didn't see Ferris Bueller until I was about 20?
Really?
Well,
yeah,
how
I swear to God.
What did you think of it when you saw it? Like, was it...
I loved it.
Yeah, cool.
I had and truly worn my VHS down by that time.
Totally.
Never seen it. Yeah. I watched it with my first girlfriend.
9 times.
Yeah. Watching with my first girlfriend, I'm like, how have I never seen this?
I don't know, because it's always on TV. Like, it was on TV
and
for
that
about
movie's
10 years. Like, throughout the 90s, it was seemingly always on a Friday night.
That movie featured
maybe you
Hollywood,
had a
Hollywood pedophile, and, like, the loved ones have the father figure. Like, there's a... Yeah. No.
Which one?
Is it Jeffrey Jones.
Jeffrey Jones, yeah.
Was he?
Oh, yeah. Hell yeah. Have you not noticed he's not in any movies anymore?
I swear to God, I had no idea.
Yeah, he's a big sex pest.
Oh, because he was in Ravenous as well, wasn't he?
Yes, and he was in bloody Beetlejuice, and he was a fantastic character actor.
Wow!
Yeah,
I swear, blind. Every time come every time I get on a podcast with
he's
you
got
two,
a shock. Yeah,
yeah, I get a shock. Last time I found out about the sex Mack. Cult, Alison Mack sex cult. How come you guys are just like?
How come we're all over it, Jared?
I know.
What
I want to
know so much.
Every time I show up, you guys are like, no. Here's another sex pass for you.
Can you pass the Vaseline?
All right, my favorite teen film, Pretty in Pink.
Oh,
written by
good one.
John Hughes. Great cast. I mean, it's got Molly Ringwald, Andrew McCarthy, John Cryer, James Spader, Harry Dean Stanton, Annie Potts, and even Andrew Dice Clay, who pops up in a bit part.
Heartbreaking film.
It is
savage.
Every time I watch, I've seen this film a million times. Tell you what, it's actually showing at the Astor on Sunday. I'm thinking about going. But every time I watch it, obviously I know the way this film's going to go. But every time I just hope that maybe Ducky gets a look in and he'll get that dance and they'll get together. You know, I like Andrew McCarthy and I like his character, but I really love Ducky.
I
love John Cryer outside of Two and a Half Men.
And they remade that film as Some Kind of Wonderful.
It's true, actually. It's true. Yeah.
What would your honorable mention be then?
Cameron Crowe's Say Anything.
It's a good answer.
He's thought about this before.
He has thought about that answer on the drop of a hat.
I could probably name my top five. Then because you thought about it. Number three. No, this is just off the top of my head. Yeah.
That's in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
What would your honourable mentions be?
Shit, I haven't had time to really compile this in my head.
Not another teen movie?
Fuck off.
I love that movie. I do really love that movie.
That's hilarious. Serious,
no,
really?
It's hilarious. Really? Yeah, I really think it's a great... It's just a weird kind of... It's like, you know, it came at that time when there was all of these...
Saturation.
Yeah, those type of films. It's, you know, parody a lot movies. Of talent. But most of the parodies it was doing was of 80s teen films, which I thought would kind
and
of
hey,
be
this
lost.
This was the arrival of the new breed of slapstick directors that took over from the Zuckers.
Yeah,
and, you know,
totally.
And now you've mentioned that time frame, I think Varsity Blues is up there for me.
Varsity Blues?
I don't know
really?
If I've ever seen it.
I love Varsity Blues.
I feel like I might have seen it.
Did John Voight get an Oscar nom for that?
I don't believe so.
He should have. He's phenomenal in that film.
What about James Van Der Beek, though? How was the beak?
He's
was the beak?
Yeah. He's all right.
Yeah. That was
his big, like...
That was his big step away from Dawson's Puddle.
Amy Smart was in it, and she was in Non-Nub Team Movie.
Wow, there you go.
Or was she? No, she wasn't.
She was in
they parody it. They parody they it with the whipped cream. Ah,
yeah,
that's
what
I'm thinking.
What
they do indeed. All right, well, so that was pretty much a digression. I don't really have.
It's like,
wait, is it you want to? You got any more honourable mentions? You didn't do an honourable mention.
Carrie?
No, I didn't. Honourable mention.
Yeah, good pick. And that kind of ties in well with this.
Hell yes.
Rumblefish.
Ooh, yeah, wow, right. Yeah. Okay, well, there you go. Okay. All right. I feel like I probably should have chosen something that's like. Oh, maybe,
Rusty James. I love Rumblefish.
Blackboard Jungle. Let's be cinephiles now.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, wow.
High School High.
No, that wasn't John Huston. That was Asphalt Jungle.
High School High with John Lovitz.
John Lovitz.
Also featuring the Quad City DJs. Come on, ride the train. It's the choo-choo ride.
Good. Song? Good.
From the mid-90s.
You know, High School High. That was a Pat Proft written film. Mm. That is an undervalued film.
It's totally undervalued.
Firstly, when he lifts her skirt and tries to fuck her and says, oh my God, you're a virgin. And she just had her panties on. She forgot to take her panties off. But when when the DJ starts scratching and he goes and takes his record up and it's Rhinestone Cowboy. Oh my God, that's fucking great. He goes, I'm a Rhinestone.
I remember that.
So good.
But
so
good. The turn he does in the crowd, because he walks off really proud as punch that he gave him this new vinyl. When he hears the scratch, he does a beeline back to the bloody turntable.
Yeah, because it's like his prized record. Oh, it's a classic. All right, so we can move on from the slight digression of teen films.
Big digression.
Yeah, all right. Okay, so, you know, this is part where I traditionally wrap it up. But before I do that, I always talk about the best available version of the film out there.
Why don't you?
And you can't go past the Australian Blu-ray. It is the definitive version of the film worldwide. It's got a commentary track by Sean Byrne, a very informative and engaging, and he's a very likable kind of character. Like, I've never met Sean ever, but you know, listening to him just sounds like a mate. And you know, he's quite honest about his influences, and he's quite gracious of everyone that worked on the film, and will, you know, give them kudos. Terrific commentary track. It's actually got a couple of his short films, two of his shorts on
there.
Cool. And one of them, which I think was called Advantage Satan, is a phenomenal short. If you haven't seen it, you should definitely watch it. When you watch a short like that, you can see so much potential this director. I mean, obviously with Loved Ones, but this is a guy that should be making a lot more films. Like, the next film the guy went on to make was
The Devil's,
Candy, which was like 5-6 years later.
2015.
It's a long stretch. And I mean, it was written and directed by him as well. You know, I didn't love The Devil's Candy. You know, I think there's some solid ideas in there, but again, he was working,
it's that whole leaping into the American market type
exactly
thing.
You've there's got a lot more people in there that interfere with the project.
It was what happened with Jeffrey Wright when he went and did Cherry Falls.
Cherry Falls
is good in hindsight.
Yeah,
but underwhelming when he's gone straight from Metal Skin to Romper Stomper.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Same thing that happened.
Cherry Falls was really good.
It was good.
Particularly, I mean, particularly sad, obviously, given the Brittany's death. But Cherry Falls, it was even back in the day.
It was the most brutal of all those slashes.
Yeah, and it was dropped. I think it was Rockville Film, wasn't it, that dropped it?
Could have been.
Something like that. It was
Magna Pacific.
It was a no-namer that got a local indie.
Yeah.
And it, you know, knocked me. I'm like, how did this bypass?
Jay Moore? Arguably Jay Moore at the height of when he was popular.
Yeah.
It cashed in on the teen slasher, but it really, really upped the ante.
It did a good job. A solid job.
Great cinematography.
The massacre scene is just...
The interesting thing about that film, because there's a great Blu-ray that's come out through... And you know what's really weird? I actually looked at Cherry Falls for this episode, but realized I think it was like 1999, or it was on the cusp or something.
And you go by decade.
Yeah, and I was like, oh no, it's just missed it.
Because I would have been working a Blockbuster at the time, so it would have been 1999, 2000, yeah.
Yeah, the studio interference, that was comes up on the commentary track with Jeffrey Wright, how much studio interference it was, because they wanted an R-rated film to begin with. They wanted an R-rated grisly horror, and then as the film was, I think it was in the still production before they got to the edit, had gone, no, it has to be, we have to get it, bring it down, bring the rating down. You know, and they've cut elements, and a lot of the materials, which bizarre, because it's not that long ago, no longer exists. So there's like scenes that were shot that, you know, they can't put on a DVD because they can't find the materials. Which is weird because it's in an era when that stuff really didn't get lost.
He flirted
with the tropes the way that Wes Craven did in Scream, you know? Like he did, the whole concept of it is the trope of the virgin that dies, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a cool film.
The red herrings and, you know, it was... Yeah, Cherry Falls is underrated.
Very cool film. Another digression in the wrap-up.
Yeah.
the Blu-ray, it's also got like a Q&A from Toronto. It's got some... Actually, no, yes. It has got a featurette that's made by my mate Tommy.
Oh, wow.
Who was the runner on the film. It's called My Super Awesome Featurette or Runner Story or something like that, which is... It's really cool because, like, I remember when it came out on Blu-ray and Tommy saying, oh, I've got a special feature that's going to be on there. I was like, oh, my friend's done a special feature on it. On a disc, that's awesome. And I'm like, oh my god, it's like told through his eyes, this is the experience, and it's pretty fun. So it's a pretty cool little thing. Another interesting note though is film was released, well, played MIFF in 2009, played a bunch of festivals, didn't come out in Australia till like late 2010. I think it was like pretty much like November 2010.
It was pretty late from what I remember.
It was a long, I mean, that generally happens with a lot of Aussie films that play, you know, Aussie festivals. But the weirdest thing was, it got like a DVD release in the UK a month before, so it was already being torrented and pirated before it opened in Australian cinemas. But then the US, Paramount picked it up for US distribution. They released it like 3 years later. They released it like in the summer of 2012. In limited release, but they released it in summer, which is odd, because like it's not typically a summer film. Maybe you do it around October in the Halloween horror season. They did it in the summer of 2012, but so many years later, it just baffled me as to why. Yeah. And again, piracy was very rampant at that point in time. So.
And it's a really good Halloween film.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I've seen people dress up in cosplay.
And it would suit, because I think that around that time of the year would be coming up to the prom in the States. So you could tie in with that sort of thing.
Yeah, you begin to the end of the
season. The fact that Australia doesn't really even have proms, you know, like, it appeals to that American market big time.
Yeah. Very unusual decision to delay the release for so long. But yeah, that really brings us to the end of the podcast. Have you guys got anything further to add?
What would be, I mean, horror-wise, what do you reckon would be other films to check out like it? You know, it's easy to say Pretty in Pink and all that. Like, they're the easy, obvious ones. Yeah,
well, the one I mentioned earlier, although the humour, it's very much more of an obvious type comedy, but it does do the switcheroony really well, is that The Babysitter, the McGee film that was on Netflix globally.
Such a great movie.
Because it's way more over the top, and it's definitely going for more comical angle, but that's probably... What a draw comparison.
Jennifer's body, maybe, even though it's supernatural and all that.
It's very confused.
The vibe.
It has the same feel, yeah.
We did a podcast about it.
Like, I like it, but it's a confused film. It doesn't sort of know what it wants to be.
Jennifer's body?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a mess.
We've already mentioned them. All Cheerleaders Must Die, Carrie, like, they're good comparisons, I suppose.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Awkward Girl horror films. Yeah, this is a whole entire subgenre of those films.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
All right. Well, that said, I just want to shout out to the Screaming Meanies who perform our intro and outro music. Thank you very much, Screaming Meanies, for that. And guys, until next time, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Adios.